Welcome to studentofthebible.com. I'm your host, Renee, and I'm a Bible student. I'm glad you are, too. Thank you so much for joining. Pray for discernment and ask God to show you how you can share this information with others and be a blessing. Welcome to my podcast on Caesarea Philippi. This is an area mentioned twice in the New Testament. In Hebrew, it's called Beneas. In this podcast, we're going to try to understand this area's historical and geographical significance to then maybe help us better understand why Jesus had two very important and significant events that happened near there. During my 2020 visit to Israel, we visited this area in the northern part of Israel called Caesarea Philippi. It's located at the base of what's frequently snow-capped Mount Hermon, H-E-R-M-O-N. Today, you can walk around the ruins of what was at one time a really beautiful Roman city, complete with Roman baths, the palace, and even we found ruins of a synagogue. It's located about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. And you can see some pictures of this place on my website, studentofthebible.com. In Caesarea Philippi is one of the largest springs that feeds the Jordan River. There's an impressive 32-foot waterfall. It's the largest in Israel. And then there's a cave that goes deep into the mountain. Caesarea Philippi is located near the area called the Golan Heights, which today is a pretty dangerous area bordered by Syria and Lebanon. The place is lush and green and cool, and you can really seem to understand why it would have been the perfect place in a desert for religious worship of all kinds. Evidence of numerous temples that had been built during the Greek Hellenistic and the Roman periods are still there. Many historians believe that this is the place that at one time was called Baal, B-A-A-L, Hermon, and then Baal Gad, G-A-D, and then was later called Peneus, named after the Greek god Pan. We'll talk about this hotbed of pagan worship in a minute, but we're not just going to talk about the pagan worship that took place here. We're going to talk about how this ends up being a very important place in Jesus's ministry. Why would Jesus pick such a notorious place for such an important conversation? Perhaps you'll better understand this once we discover what kind of place it was, and then we can start to surmise why it is that Matthew has recorded in 16:13 that Jesus was actually here on two different occasions, for the great confession and then the transfiguration. So geographically, Caesarea Philippi is situated right near the base of Mount Hermon. And for thousands of years, it was a city dominated by immoral activities and pagan worship. But it's not far from Galilee, only about 25 miles. But the city's religious practices couldn't be more different from the nearby Jewish towns. Now, we know from the Old Testament that this area was once the center for, as I said, Baal worship, B-A-A-L, pronounced either Baal or Baal. Baal, in the ancient mythology of Canaan, he was the god of life and fertility, and he often took the shape of a ram or a bull. Although I've seen some pictures of him holding a lightning bolt, and so they feel he might have had something to do with the weather also. Now, this pagan god Baal was in mortal combat with a competing god, Mot, M-O-T. Now, he was the god of death and sterility. So we had life and fertility versus death and sterility. So it was believed that if Baal succeeded, there would be a 7-year cycle of fertility. But if he was defeated, Mott would bring 7 years of drought and famine. And archaeologists believe that this Baal worship dates back to 1400 BC, if not earlier. Here's an interesting side note. So Baal has also been referred to as Beelzebub, literally the Lord of the Flies, or the devil. Neo-pagan and Wiccan groups? Well, today, many of them have chosen Baal as their personal deity in worship. Yikes. Well, back then, Baal worship was a huge temptation for the Israelites. Even though they were warned time and again to destroy all pagan gods and worship only Yahweh God, Baal worship becomes a really big stumbling block during the time of Judges and even in the Book of Kings. The story of Ahab and Jezebel and her worship of Baal, and then that eventual showdown with Elijah that's described in 1 Kings chapter 18. Well, in this story, the final score is God won, 450 Baal prophets, zero. Now in 2 Kings chapter 21 verse 3, that tells us the story of King Hezekiah's son rebuilding shrines to Baal that his father had torn down. I like what Christianity.com has to say. It says, if anyone could get an award for having the worst neighbors, it would go to the ancient Israelites, who didn't border a single country, who didn't try to destroy them or convince them to worship their pagan gods, unquote. Now, in the nearby city of Dan, that's where the Israelite king Jeroboam, who was actually the first king of the northern kingdom, this is where he offers sacrifices to a golden calf and basically leads Israel into idolatry. That's in 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 26 through 28. So Caesarea Philippi eventually becomes this center of pagan worship, moving from Baal to another pagan god called Pan, P-A-N. Pan in Greek mythology was a fertility god, half man, half goat. Now, this is probably weird, but I actually picture C.S. Lewis's character, Mr. Tumnus, the one in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when I think of Pan, because this goat man creature is often pictured playing a flute. Creepy, right? Now, C.S. Lewis, he actually wanted his Mr. Tumnus to represent Judas, who betrays Jesus, but I actually think he looks an awful lot like the depictions I have seen of Pan. Just saying. So, the city we're talking about today, called Caesarea Philippi, when the Greeks were there, it was called Panias, P-A-N-I-A-S, in Pan's honor. Pan is actually where we get the word panic. So I mentioned that there's this really deep cave in what is now called Caesarea Philippi. And it was in this cave that Pan was originally worshipped. It's actually called the Grotto of Pan. Now, it's said that Alexander the Great was so impressed with the beauty of this place that he made a sanctuary there. The Greeks moved the worship of Pan then to the outside of the cave, and they created an outdoor sanctuary dedicated to him right next to the water that was actually coming out of the cave. Now, here's the thing. Natural features always impressed the Greeks. They were really moved by beauty. But they truly believed that this area was the dwelling place of the gods. And to them, nothing produced more awe and terror than a place identified as the cave where the god Pan dwelt. The Greeks believed that Pan was the god responsible for all those scary noises that you hear in the forest. And then many mysteries and unexplained things were always associated with Pan. Again, hence the word panic. Now, today, when you visit, you can see on the outside of the cave are these hollowed out areas that kind of look like windowsills. And this is where statues, like mini statues of the gods, would be placed. And then next to the statues, they found coins. So it appears that people would make donations to their most favorite god. One of the gods who got a windowsill was this god called Echo. And he was a mountain nymph and apparently Pan's partner. And then another area was dedicated to Pan's father, who was Hermes. So the Romans, they come along, and they're heavily influenced by the Greeks. And so if the gods were good enough for the Greeks, they'd be good enough for the Romans, although sometimes undergoing a name change here and there. So when this area falls under Roman rule, they kind of continue this tradition of pagan worship, human sacrifices, all those great things. And the Romans associated Pan with astrology and with the Roman Capricorn, because to them, Pan was a seer and a fortune teller. In 20 BC, Caesar Augustus gives this area to Herod the Great. The area is called, at this time, Panaeus. It hasn't yet been called Caesarea Philippi. Well, Herod the Great, super grateful. He builds this marble temple to Caesar Augustus, probably as a way of thanking him. And you can actually still see some of the ruins of this temple. And you just remember that Roman emperors were also considered to be gods. So making a temple dedicated to Caesar, while extravagant, it wasn't considered strange. Now, Herod the Great dies in 4 BC. And he bequeaths this area to one of his sons, Philip, who, you guessed it, names the area Caesarea Philippi. Now, Philip the Tetrarch, he ends up rebuilding this city, and he changes the name to Caesarea Philippi to honor the emperor, Tiberius Caesar, and to honor his own name, Philip. Well, Philip then makes it a capital, and he rules the area until 33 AD. So he's ruling it during the time of Jesus. And he even depicted the shrine of Pan on his coins. Okay, now this is hard for us to understand today, but to the ancient pagan mind, the cave that I've been talking about, at Caesarea Philippi, they thought it was a gate to the underworld. Now, back then, water actually flowed directly from the cave, and so they thought the cave was this bottomless pit where the fertility gods would live during the winter. And they thought that the gods emerged during the springtime, and they saw the water as a symbol of the underworld and as the way that the gods would travel from the underworld into our world. And they actually referred to this as the gate of Hades. Therefore, they committed really detestable acts to worship the false gods in the cave itself. And during the time of Jesus, people were still worshiping these pagan gods. That's why it's so significant that Jesus appeared here in an extremely significant way. Jesus knew the temptations of the people. So honestly, he could have hung out in a synagogue during his entire public ministry, but he didn't. Jesus went to where the people were, and he didn't go to the perfect people, self-proclaimed, of course. He went to the sinners. Our pastor actually gave a really interesting sermon on the significance of this place and the interaction between Jesus and his disciples at Caesarea Philippi. This is recounted by Matthew in chapter 16, verses 13 through 16 are what we're going to look at right now. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Okay, consider what Jesus has done here. In the Gospels, Jesus asks 307 questions. Here's a lesson for all leaders. Ask questions. You'll find out a lot more that way. Now, Jesus is the Son of God, and he already knows the answers to all the questions he's going to ask. So you might say, why bother then? The reason Jesus asked the question is so that his followers can learn. Think of the context of the question and where Jesus is asking his disciples. He's asking his closest friends first, who do the people, the masses, say that I am? That's important. His disciples needed to consider their audience. They were living in the dirty, pagan-filled, hedonistic world. They're literally standing in front of what was called the Gate of Hades. Who did the people of his day think he was? And really, who did they think he was? Standing in the center of pagan worship, what were they hoping for? John the Baptist back from the dead? The returned prophet Elijah? You know, the Bible did say someone like Elijah would return. Was he the prophet Jeremiah? Jeremiah did speak out against pagan worship, so based on where they were, maybe that wasn't a stretch. Or was he just another prophet? You know, the answers weren't surprising because the book of Deuteronomy told them God would raise up a prophet from among the people. Now notice that Jesus doesn't jump up and down and try to correct them. What does he do? He asks a follow-up question. Again, leaders, take note. Jesus doesn't answer the question for them. He waits for them to answer. But what about you? Who do you say that I am? How long did Jesus have to wait for an answer? Were they all looking at each other, or were they all looking down and not making eye contact? Well, Matthew doesn't tell us. But what Matthew does say is that in this place of pagan worship, at this place literally called the Gate of Hell, Peter answers, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Matthew 16:17-20. Now, what a contrast between who Peter was saying Jesus was and the false, dead, worthless gods they were standing in front of. This is Peter's mic drop moment. Jesus replies, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Jesus says, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Now, when Jesus brought his disciples to this area, honestly, they must have been shocked. Caesarea Philippi was like a red light district in their world, and devout Jews would have avoided it like the plague. There were despicable acts that were committed here. I actually like how BibleHistory.com describes it. Quote, "It was a city of people eagerly knocking on the doors of hell." Jesus presented a clear challenge with his words at Caesarea Philippi. He didn't want his followers hiding from evil. He wanted them to storm the gates of hell, unquote. This place was referred to as the Gates of Hades. Jesus was very aware of the powers of evil and darkness present here, and he was openly defying it. The church, us, the ecclesia, the called out ones, will not be taken down. The gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. This is Jesus's cheerleader speech. Remember what Gates did? Gates kept things out and kept things in. Gates kept people safe. Gates were defensive structures in the ancient world. By saying that the gates of hell would not overcome it, Jesus suggested that those gates were going to be attacked. Get ready, church. Build this church and nothing will stand against it, not even the gates of hell. But they will try. This church will be able to overcome the worst of the worst evils that the world can throw at us. But Jesus is saying, get ready. Jesus is standing in front of an area that had prostitutes and child sacrifices and bestiality and all kinds of perversions. And he boldly said, this church will stand against this. Now here Peter has boldly revealed who Jesus is. And Jesus has now revealed who Peter is. Petra, the rock. Now Peter will later remind believers in his letter, 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 6, what this meant. He said that we are the church built on the foundations of the apostles and the prophets, and Jesus is the cornerstone. All believers are joined together in what was revealed, the true identity of Christ that was revealed at Caesarea Philippi. What else happened here? I said there were two really important events. Another event is the Transfiguration. It's believed, based on what was written, that this event occurred either on Mount Hermon or nearby Mount Tabor. Many believe because they were just in Caesarea Philippi, and the text says Peter, James, and John went with Jesus and climbed a high mountain, that Mount Hermon, which is right there, is the tallest mountain in Israel. Or Mount Tabor is only 7 miles away. It's 7 miles south of Caesarea Philippi. So again, very nearby. I'll have a separate podcast at some point on the Transfiguration. So I'm just going to give you high level details so you understand, again, how amazing this event was so close to Caesarea Philippi. Peter, James, and John, during what we call the Transfiguration, saw an amazing vision of who Jesus really is. They see Jesus' true divinity, which, remember, Peter has just revealed right in front of the gates of hell. They see Jesus transfigured in front of their very eyes into a man who is wearing a white robe. And his face, it says, is shining like the sun. And then they see him talking to the ancient prophets, Moses and Elijah. Okay, if that's not shocking enough, they then hear the very voice of God coming from a cloud that again affirms who Jesus is. This is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. Let's summarize what we've learned. Caesarea Philippi was an evil, pagan-filled place, often referred to as the Gate of Hades. Jesus boldly affirms who he is and gives them and also us a huge mission speech on the doorstep of this evil place. Attack evil, build a church, and the very place is filled with immorality and corruption. Yikes! It appears that Jesus did not want his followers to hide from evil, but literally to storm the gates of hell. I know it's so tempting for us to crawl back into bed and not be bold about our faith. Are we living in a time that is that different from the time of Jesus? I actually think the tide is turning, and it's becoming way more tempting again to believe in false gods. Who is our modern-day Baal? We turn to alcohol, money, the lure of fame and prosperity, and all kinds of false idols of political parties and ideologies. Yeah, we want to escape the pain of the world we're in by worshiping the false promises of a new political leader or a new get-rich scheme. But here's the thing, it's hard for us to fight evil when we're wallowing in it. Luke records that after Jesus gave this pep talk about storming the gates of hell, he gave this caution. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory. Honestly, faith in God is the only thing we can count on. We really are standing at the Grotto of Pan, staring at the gates of Hades and a world who is falling for false gods. We need to be the church that Jesus started right there at Caesarea Philippi. We need to go forth and not hide the one true God. I wonder if we were standing there with the 12, who would we say that Jesus is? Yeah, we need to live it and profess it boldly. Jesus knew his followers would face ridicule and anger as they tried to confront evil. And his words came as a sharp challenge. No matter how fierce the resistance, his followers should never hide from their faith. We live in a world that is failing to deliver on their promise of happiness and prosperity. We need to point people to the one true God. No, Jesus did not promise an easy life, but he did deliver on the promise of salvation, which is really the only kind of prosperity that really matters. There's a great website called That the World May Know. I go to it quite often and actually focus on the family has partnered with them. So I'm going to end this podcast with a quote from their site. Today, Christians must heed the words of our Savior, especially when we're tempted to hide our faith because of embarrassment or fear. Our world is filled with those who will have gained the world but lost their souls. If we hide our faith, they may never find the salvation they need. As we listen to Jesus' challenge today, we as Christians should ask ourselves the important question, when it comes to the battle against evil, are we on the defense or the offense? What side of the gate are we standing on? Let's fight the good fight. Go and be a blessing.